Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is the Writer's Lounge, show number 83. This is May 11th, 2015. I am your host, Tom Riedel, and soon coming to join me here is my guest co-host, Bobby Hughes-Millman. And if you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the Writer's Lounge, you're more than happy to run over there and take a look at the blog site, which is located over at tomriedel.com/blog. And in the upper left-hand corner, there is a radio player there. You just click on your favorite author, listen to the show while you read the interviews or the reviews of the books that are over there on the Blog Talk Radio site. Of course, you can go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and click on Facebook link. It'll take you to Facebook. Go ahead and follow us there. And also, you can follow us on Twitter. Contact us the old-fashioned way at twl11@yahoo.com. And upcoming guest authors we have on next time, which would be May 25th, would be Christy Tijoran, and she wrote Uncharted Secrets. And then later on, coming up on June 8th, special announcement, we're going to have on the author of The Martian. It's a new book that's going to be made into a movie with Matt Damon coming out on November 25th. His name is Andy Weir, and he will be here on the Writer's Lounge on June 8th. So mark your calendars for that. It'll be a very exciting show. It'll be very exciting to talk to an author, a first-time author, who has not only hit it in the bookshelf, but he's also hit it in Hollywood. So that'll be really fun, and I hope you will join us for that. Our sponsor for today's show, as always, is Magic Pen Web Design. Offers its clients a simple, effective, and affordable approach to website design development. Fill out the free estimate form over at magicpenwebdesign.com and let Magic Pen help you to sell that next book with a website design that works its magic for you. And if you would like to call in today and talk to our guest author, who is Dave Moore, who wrote Gear Up, Shut Up, another high-flying adventure with Dave, you can do that by calling us at toll-free 877-878-1436 and or 626-213-5613. And right now, it's my pleasure to introduce my guest co-host, Bobby Hughes-Millman. Bobby, how are you doing tonight?
Hi, Tom. I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Doing really well, and let's get right to it here. And what's on your mind today? What's going on in the writing world in your side of your head today?
Well, you know, I was reading this really great blog by C.S. Lakin, who is an author and an editor. It's called Live, Write, Thrive, and she had a guest writer do a blog on her blog called The Best Way for Writers to Use Amazon's Pre-Order Feature. Now, this article is by Penny C. Sansevieri, and she's the founder and CEO, author, marketing experts, And she's a best-selling author. And she talks about this new feature for authors who are publishing their own through the Kindle publishing, direct publishing feature on the Kindle. And they have a way that you can do pre-order. So you can gain an excitement and get people pre-ordering your book, people who are dying for it to come out. They can feel like, okay, I have mine already set, I'm all ready to go, and when it comes out, it'll come right to me. So this is a great opportunity for, number one, for authors who are, they are publishing and promoting their own work, but it's best for those, she says, those who are already published, and who are already published and already have a, somewhat of a fan base. Mm-hmm. And it's not quite so good for people who are first time publishing, because it doesn't really help you to build the fan base as much as it allows the people who are already excited about your book to be able to get it. And so they aren't. It isn't stretched out through a long period of time that people are buying your book. They're buying it before it comes out. So yes. Once that book launches, then you have all the all those sales come in at once, and it bumps you higher on the list toward being one of those books that's a bestseller in the Amazon. Cool. So I thought it was really exciting and a very great opportunity for authors like us to be able to do that. But if you hop over to Live Right Thrive, take a look at it and read it. I have tweeted it on my Twitter, which is at Bobby_Bobby, BOBBI_BOBBI. And you can find a link to that particular article there as well. If you'd like to take a look at it and read it, it's exciting news.
Yeah, it's another one of those little cookies that they're giving us that we can kind of chew on and enjoy as authors, that all these new of-age type of technology things that are happening in the world today, and it's nice of Amazon to do that. I know they have also done some changes, and I can't tell you exactly what they are right now. Somebody mentioned it to me the other day, but they apparently have done some changes in their review process, and I'm not sure again how or what that is all about, but I do know that they've done something, and it's supposed to be better for the authors. I think it addresses some of the concerns that we had mentioned here on the show before in regards to people coming on there to post one-star reviews and never really reading a book. So I'm interested to learn more about that, and I think at some point I'll get over to Amazon and take a look. But that's nice that you could bring that to our attention, Bobby. It's always a good thing to know. And I know a couple of our authors out there right now that are fairly successful and written series of books where that can be done, where you can pre-order and make sure you get that in. So that's a good thing. And do you have anything else going on in your neck of the woods?
Just editing and writing. What we always do as writers, right?
That's right. Well, it's interesting. This thing that I've been doing now for almost 4 years is promoting first-time authors. And today I was treated to a very exciting announcement, as we did announce at the top of the show, with Andy Weir coming in here on June 8th. And he wrote The Martian, which is going to be a movie in November. Yeah, it's November 25th, and it's actually a month before the big science fiction movie, and of course everybody knows about what that is, and I guess, I even saw previews of that in 3D when Harrison Ford says, "Chewie, we're home," and it still sends chills down my back when I see it and hear it. And I can't wait for that. So I'm going to be treated to not only Star Wars, but I'm also going to be treated to learning more about and watching The Martian, which I'm really enjoying the book, and having Andy on the phone today. What an excited guy he was. He was amazing. In fact, he told me that, I said, well, you must be really busy. And he said that, yes, he was. In fact, he's been doing a little bit of flying, and he hates flying. And when he said that, I started giggling because he wrote a book about probably the longest flight of any humankind in history we'll be taking at some point in our future from here to Mars. So I had a laugh at that. But he is just a regular guy. He's got caught up in this, you know, writing of his first novel, and the publisher grabbed it, and then Hollywood got a hold of it. So, you know, it's going to be interesting not only to talk to him about, you know, the book actually, you know, the book itself, but also talk to him about the process and how he went about doing it. He told me today briefly, he said, I don't know how I did it. He says, but I did it. And so, well, it goes to show that there's a little bit of luck involved, and there's a lot of skill, and there's, you know, obviously if you know somebody who knows somebody else, that helps too. And I imagine in your experience, you've probably seen a lot of that excitement, maybe not from first-time authors, but from actresses and actors who kind of step out onto the big screen. It's got to be pretty exciting to be able to do that.
You know, the entertainment industry is just one of those really weird industries where, like Andy Weir, you never know what will happen. You never know what gets them excited. I had so many people who would call my office and say, "Oh my gosh, I have a role. What do I do now? I've never had that." It's as exciting as an author getting their first publishing agreement. You just can't sleep. People definitely have. It's such a thrill for them to be able to have that happen in their lives and to be able to tell their family. The excitement dies down once you get on the set, because it is nothing like you would anticipate once you get on the set.
Right. I can imagine. And see it in the theater on a big screen is nothing the way it is when you're actually putting it together. And I guess the film, again, The Martian, has already been made. It's done. It's just gone through the editing process, or in the middle of the editing process. And the director for that film is Ridley Scott. He is, if you remember, famous for another sci-fi flick way back in, I think, the 70s called The Alien. And, of course, mm-hmm. he also was involved in Blade Runner. So there's two good movies to his credit, and there's a lot of buzz around, and I've been doing a lot of research today where they're talking about this movie, The Martian, possibly up for an Oscar. So it's going to be fun as we move on through 2015 and get close to the end, and there's going to be a lot of really good movies out there at the end that will be up for the Oscar, and I'm so excited for that. So, sometimes when life kind of puts you on a, you know, kind of a sad course, and then you get knocked around a little bit, then there's excitement like this comes along, and you just kind of perk right back up again, because you can feel the excitement. When I talked to Andy today, you can feel it in his voice, and you really, really appreciate life. But anyway, I was on vacation for 2 weeks, and first week was great. Was able to get back to Central New York. I did sit down and talk to James McAllister, who we had on the last show. We had a nice little chat. He gave me another book, and it was just really neat to meet him in person and to talk to him. Wish I could do that with every author that's been on the program, and there's a few that I have to get to see, including yourself, at one point in time here in the future. So, it's fun. It's fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm excited for you to come out to Utah and visit me.
Yeah.
Anytime, pal.
Definitely make the trip. And now let's get on with the show here. Let's get to their main event. We're going to go back into the skies again. We're going to talk to Dave Moore, who's been on the Writer's Lounge show before, and he wrote another book. His newest book is called Gear Up, Shut Up. It was, of course, written by Dave Moore and published by Amazon Digital Services in 2015, and you may purchase it at amazon.com/Kindle. You can visit the author on Facebook and at moremotivated.com. That's M-O-O-R-E, motivated.com. This is what Amazon has to say about Dave's book. Moore takes a disruptive approach in building teams and developing leaders that creates cohesion, maximizing results while minimizing human error, keeping safety first. He creates an environment where others are encouraged to speak up and challenge one another, spawning new thoughts and ideas. Moore's unique background and insight allows him to be as effective addressing the men and women on the shop floor, showing them how to engage and connect with management or the C-level executive. And this is what I had to write about after I read the book, Gear Up, Shut Up. On December 17, 1903, the Wright brothers took to the skies in the first airplane flight at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, on December 17, 1997, exactly 94 years after that first flight. Dave Moore took flight in a Blanca aircraft, but shortly after he left the ground, he crashed into a wooded area in Steubenville, Ohio. Dave almost lost his life there in the woods, but miraculously he survived and he has gone on to become a motivational speaker and author. In his latest book, Gear Up, Shut Up, he talks to us about being a leader, but as he points out in his book, you don't have to be in charge to be a leader. You can contribute to the success of any group, even if you are just a team member. He gives us examples in the form of the many experiences that he's had as a pilot, and after each story, he gives us valuable lessons and takeaways from each experience. The stories are edge of your pilot seat exciting, and he also engages the reader in some very high-flying humorous snippets. Gear Up, Shut Up is extremely thought-provoking, and you will remember the examples and lessons the next time you need to manage a difficulty in your life. I enjoyed the flight, and with that, I would like to bring on one of my favorite captains in the air, Mr. Dave Moore. How are you doing, Dave?
Good, Tom. How are you doing?
Doing great. Doing great.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks. Your book sounds so intriguing. I have not had a chance to read it yet, but I am so chomping at the bit to want to read that.
Well, yeah, I know. I hear you. I know you like the science fiction, and I bring the nonfiction. But I hope little Tom can attest to it. I try to make it a lot of fun. So.
I love all kinds of stuff, and you know, this is something that my husband would love also. Anything about planes? It just sounds so great. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, this book is. It's not really about planes. It's about leadership and.
About leadership, you know, too, right? Sorry
well,
about
one,
that.
One of the hard, yes. One of the hardest things to teach anymore is leadership, because you know how you lead just depends on, there's so many factors that go into it, and you can only develop yourself as a leader. Well, I'm 40 now, and I've been put in so many unique positions that I've been able to really really have an opportunity to shine. And I wasn't always the one in charge, but not being in charge and being in charge, and this is kind of a reflection back. And I use 13 stories. One of the greatest compliments I get, especially when I'm speaking, is after I'm done, you know, after when people come up to me, they say, you know, the best thing about when you speak is you don't have to say the point of the story is, you know, you can just kind of take away from it. And then, you know, you can modify or use the different situations that I've had to go through and use it in your life, because really we just need to be exposed. And, you know, luckily the military gives you a lot of exposure to a lot of leadership, and then being through plane crashes and stuff like that just kind of piles on top. So
That certainly helps when you've been through a plane crash like you have. We don't want you crashing anymore, but could you, and I'm not sure if you're up to doing this, I'm not sure how you got this thing planned, but could you read an excerpt from your book?
Oh, absolutely. And this one's from the story is called Shamu Wins Through the Math. And like I said before, there's short stories that I give, about 13 of them, and they all have a disruptive leadership takeaway from it. So this one's about situational awareness. And just situational awareness is seeing the whole picture, seeing everything that's going on. Oftentimes we just get focused on right what we're doing or what's right in front of us. And this is an example where I did. So here it goes. This is from the middle of the story. With a full stadium, the show began. It was wonderful, and as promised, they asked for a volunteer. I raised my hand and got picked as planned. The trainer grabbed my hand and whisked me up to the staging area. The skin on my face was tight and dry as I stood on the stage out of the relatively cool of the 110-degree shaded stadium seats. Shamu slid up on the ramp as planned, and I held her fish up over her head. She chirped and nodded her head up and down, wanting the treat. I held strong, as my job was now to taunt the killer whale for the audience. Shamu acted accordingly, and as promised, she spit some water on me. Well, let me tell you, a killer whale doesn't spit a little bit of water on you. It's more like a fire hose unleashing. And the water in her tank was about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, below ALS ice bucket on steroids. It took the breath right out of me. The trainer grabbed my hand and raced me down to the side where the glass of the enormous killer whale's tank as I grasped for each breath. A well-trained and disciplined military officer, I would overcome this obstacle. As I spotted Shamu swimming in her tank, I started a series of hand gestures to guide the whale into her next trip. I was so focused on these gestures, I truly believed in my heart that I was going to make the show happen. My day told me later that the trainer was standing behind me, laughing, talking on his headpiece microphone with an umbrella over his head. That whale came over right where I was and propelled herself as high as she could, hitting that water right where I was standing. It felt like Niagara Falls, the 50-degree water coming over the side of that glass. As I tried to keep my composure and complete the mission, I quickly found myself out of breath. I fell forward, hitting my dry, tan face off the glass in the process and breaking open the skin on my nose. Blood gushed down my face, and the salt water and sweat stung the tissue under my broken epidermis. I stood, a faint, bloody, defeated man being projected on a gigantic jumbo screen in the Shamu Theater.
Wow.
So that was a story when I was up in Corpus, or when I was stationed in Corpus Christi, and I went up to San Antonio, Texas, up to SeaWorld, and I was so focused on what I was doing or what I thought I was doing, I didn't really see everything going on. And I believe, to my knowledge, that's the last time that they started used people from the audience for the Shamu shows. I'm not sure about that. I know they don't do that anymore, but they were pretty worried that I was going to sue them, and that was the last thing on my mind. Then it take me back. I mean, I split my nose open, and if you've ever been to San Antonio, Texas, it's probably about 125 degrees, and when that 50-degree water hit me, it just absolutely took the breath away from me.
Yeah, I can relate to that, Dave, because I went to a similar show out in San Diego several years ago, and they have a Shamu, I can't remember the exact place where it was, but when you were writing that and when I was reading that, I remembered that experience that I had with Shamu, and I could imagine just watching you standing there and that happening to you. And but we really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun, great entertainment, but I can imagine how you felt there all bloodied on that big screen. It must have been a bit unnerving for you. But can you... Dave, can you define for us what disruptive leadership is and what's your goal of writing this book?
Well, disruptive leadership is it's stepping back from the norm. It's working, you know, in leadership now, like you look at it's no longer can leadership just be hierarchical. You can't just I talk about leading with personal power and leading with position power. I've had the opportunity to do both. And the one thing that I learned is position power gets you bare minimum service. And I talk about that in my book. You know, if you're just doing something because of your rank or your position, people are going to do the bare minimum they have to work for you. Leading with personal power and disruptive leadership is about, it's about bringing the team together but working outside the norm. It's not just making change for the sake of making change. One of the examples I like to use is the U.S. tax code just recently reached 4 million words. The people writing the tax code can't even understand all of the tax code, but they just keep adding to it, they just keep adding to it, they just keep adding to it, and nobody can really understand what it is. Disruptive leadership is just coming with a fresh new approach. It's coming from the outside, and saying, look, we're going to take a new look at this instead of just taking, well, this is how we always did it, or, you know, that's the worst mindset. Well, we've always done it like this. Well, you know, it's about coming with a new idea, because in today they say that 60% of all people belong to a social media group. So you no longer can go and mull over data, all kinds of data, and then expect to send that all the way up to the CEO and then all the way back down to the decision maker. Disruptive leadership's about teaching your people to be able to make decisions at all levels in the organization. It's about empowering your people. So it's not just top heavy. It's about hiring people and then empowering them and giving them the responsibility and the authority to make decisions by setting guidelines that they can operate within. So it's not so much, it's about getting the best of everybody and using their talents and abilities instead of them just going through the motions and doing what you're telling them to do.
Yeah, and I would imagine it's when I read that word disruptive, I think of chaos, but it really isn't that. It's more for the workers out on the floor than the, like you say, in the top-heavy management style that some companies run. Sometimes we're forced to make decisions as floor people than they are up at the top. So, yeah, it's better defined. I understand that. And, Bobby, do you have anything for Dave?
No, I'm really intrigued with the way you're talking about this, and I think that there are so many businesses that can benefit by doing exactly as you say, empowering their people, allowing people to make decisions at all levels of the organization, because I think it's so beneficial for everyone involved, including the leadership, to get other fresh points of view. And a lot of corporations are getting the idea that they're going to prosper more from doing that type of thing. So that's great. It's really it's beautiful that you were able to capture that and put that in your book.
Yeah. Well, Dave, in your book, you encourage us to speak up, as we just talked about, and to even challenge our leaders, but even in our workplace. But what about the risk of losing our jobs? There's a lot of people that would shy away from taking an approach, you know, somebody in their company who might be a CEO. They would be thinking, well, if I do this and I know this is right and I know I can make change that's productive here, but if I do this, I could lose my job. So how would you react to that?
Well, you know, it comes down to the way America is now, or the world is people don't usually stay with a company for 30 or 40 years. It's, you know, people are more moving in and out of companies. You know, some people do find the right company and are able to stay with them, and it's usually the more progressive companies that will allow them to speak up. But it's, you know, that's a decision you have to make. In the examples I use, it doesn't matter what branch of the service it was, but there was a pilot. And there were this particular branch of the service has a whole lot of manuals to dictate exactly how you will operate their aircraft. Well, I've had to work outside of that, but to me, I always say if I can come back and stand in front of the old man and the crew's alive and I can explain what I did, that's all that matters. And all that matters is that we're all alive. Well, there was actually a pilot who, he was flying an airplane and the airplane lost control. And he did a step in the airplane, which was turning the yaw dampener off. And he turned that yaw dampener off, and the airplane came back under control. But that book said that you will not fly that airplane without that yaw dampener on. And he turned it back on, and the airplane actually shook itself apart and killed everyone. So, you know, it comes down to you can't just follow a set of guidelines to a point. But I know that's in a very extreme situation. So what I'm saying in the book is, you know, you have to be willing – as a leader, it's your job, as a C-level executive, it's your job to create an environment where you're going to get the best and the brightest. And by doing that, you have to create an environment that's forgiving. And or otherwise, your people won't speak up. Because if I come in and I don't create an environment that's forgiving, you're never going to talk back to me. You're never going to say, hey, I think there's a better way to do this. And I don't mean talk back in a negative way, but just you're never going to bring up a point and say, hey, maybe we should go about it this way because, you know, down here on the shop floor, we see this, this, and this, and that's what's going to save us money in the long run.
Yeah, and I guess the short answer to this would be sometimes you have to take a risk to get the job done. Is that correct?
Well, Tom, you know, I mean, you look at the companies today, and you're either on the tip of the spear or, you know, you're the innovator, the imitator, or the idiot is what the saying goes. So, you know, if you're not going to stay on the tip of the spear and you don't have new, fresh ideas coming up, it comes down to the hiring process. But what I'm talking about in the book is because I've been on the top side of management and I've been on the bottom side of, you know, I've been the guy on the shop floor. So what I'm saying is it's the responsibility. It has to start at the upper management level. It has to start there for them to actually create an environment where people will speak up. Because if you're not the innovator and you're not at the tip of the spear, then you're just going to end up, you know, you're going to end up last.
Yeah. Bobby, you got anything for that? You pretty much said it all there, Dave.
Yeah, he definitely did.
I'm very passionate about it.
No, I love that you use different experiences in your life, like with things that have happened to you when you were flying to demonstrate those points. And so it's very intriguing. Yes, very interesting. And I love books that are help you to understand different parts of our personalities that can be explored and utilized to the best of our ability. So, yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. And the thing about Dave is, in this book, he mentions that it isn't about, you know, flying, but there's a lot of stories in this book where Dave will take you in the cockpit and where he has had to make decisions, some of them life and death decisions, and some of them, you know, lesser than that. But what I found interesting here today, Dave, a little side note here, is that I went in and I saw a story about Wilbur and what's the other guy's name?
Orville.
Orville and Wilbur. So I read that they were in Ohio when they had their where they lived actually in Ohio, and your plane crash was in Steubenville, Ohio, and in that plane crash you almost lost your life. And I was just wondering, how has that changed you as a person, and where do you go after you've lived through something like that?
Tom, it really just makes you look at life a whole different from a whole different perspective. You know, you actually see that, you know, life is very delicate, and you know, not to get too far into it, but it makes you go through a lot of looking inside yourself, a lot of personal, you know, what is life about. And then when it comes down to it, it's just about people. And I think I speak a lot about my book, you know, about taking care of others and looking out for others and having empathy for the people that work for you. But you know, when you go through a crash like mine, and I think I wrote in there that the guy from the NTSB said, I don't know if you believe in God or not, but you should be alive right now. And when somebody did I write that in there, Tom?
Yes, you did.
Yeah, I thought I did. And you know, when somebody lays that on you, you know, you really start taking a whole new approach to life. And you know, and I think you come to appreciate it more and more every day. You know, and it's you appreciate everything that's here, but you also want to strive to make it a better world, a better place. You know, because you really don't know. You don't know how long you're here for. You don't know. The only thing you're going to leave behind is the person you are. So when people, you know, when people look at you, your family, your friends, and, you know, you want them to have you want to have self-respect. You also want them to look at you and, you know, have respect for you. So I guess everything you do, you know, you feel like more of a responsibility for everything that you do.
And I know you related a story about Shamu, and I was really intrigued with another story, and that's that we want you to tell all the stories in the book, because everybody that's out there should be running to their bookstore to buy this book. It's an amazing book. And but I was really intrigued by one of the stories in your book, and it was the one where you flew next to Air Force One. And can you take us up there and tell us what was going on at that time when you met Air Force One?
I sure can. So we were stationed down in Miami, and I was with the Coast Guard at the time, and we were flying the H-25 Falcon jet. And the gentleman I was flying with was actually, he became a very good friend of mine. And we were both aircraft commanders, but he didn't want to, he was senior to me, senior in rank. So he was now the one to have the final authority of the airplane. So I was second in charge of the airplane. It's a 5-man crew. And, but being a friend of mine, he wanted to extend the courtesy, and that's what the disruptive takeaway is about, defining lines, clear lines for all your people. So he was trying to not have position power over me, but have the personal power over me. But the unfortunate part is, he did a good job to a point, but he wanted to be too much of a bros. And I mean, a good friend of mine. Like I'm not speaking badly about it. It was a lesson learned for both of us because we were all there. So we really didn't have clearly defined rules of who the co-pilot was, who the aircraft commander was on the ground. So we took off, Tom. We flew up. We got some smoke to bone, I believe, up in the Carolinas. And on the flight back, we were going to fly low level. And it was just a training flight. And we were going to fly low level and cut across Florida. So we're coming down the Gulf Coast. And I look over, and I'm kind of navigating. He's in the left seat at this point. And I'm navigating us through. What's that?
No, I'm just laughing. Go ahead, Dave. I'm just I'm in the cockpit with you.
Yeah, so he's in the left, and I know I have to leave a lot out, but I love to tell stories, and I feel like I hear a lot that I'm a good storyteller, especially on paper. And so we're coming down, you know, we're flying down the Gulf Coast, and I have the VFR sectional out, and you know, we're just coming down, and I'm like, you know, come right, come left, come right. And you're actually doing more because usually when you're flying in an airline, you're an IFR flight plan and you're talking to aircraft traffic control and all these people. But we were flying VFR, and, you know, with the Coast Guard, we flew low level all the time. It was no big deal for us. So we're a few hundred feet off the coast, flying down the coast, and we see Naples. And I said, hey, come right 10 degrees. And, you know, Naples class D airspace, I didn't think too much of it. And so we're flying, and I look over, and I'm like, oh, my God. I said, I didn't think they had that big of an aircraft coming out of there. And it was just something about the airplane. Now, you have to remember, we're only a few hundred feet off the ground, and we're in an A-225 Falcon jet. And I was like, and I look over, and there was just something about the airport or the airplane, and he recognized it before I did. He goes, that's Air Force One. I was like, oh, my God. We're like in formation. And nobody flies on solicitor, I mean, with Air Force One. And so just as we said that, we had an F-16 up on our tail and the other F-16 coming across our face. And they have their mask on. And the guy comes over, and the fighter pilot, and he says, Coast Guard, turn right now. Because you can imagine, we're heading southbound on the Gulf side of Florida, he says, Coast Guard, turn west, and he has his mask on. So if you ever heard a fighter pilot talk with his mask on, it's very muffled. And, well, when he said west, the guy flying, I call him Big Angry, that was our nickname for him, Big Angry thought he said turn left, but that's where Air Force One was. And he starts to turn left. I go, no. I said, go west, which is to the right. And he's like, are you sure? I'm like, I'm positive. Just come west. And so we end up putting that compass on W, and Air Force One's climbing out, you know, with its escort. And we almost flew to Corpus. I mean, we almost flew to Texas straight across the Gulf Coast. And, I mean, we were just so tense. And I kept trying to hail the F-16 pilots, and they wouldn't respond to us. So we finally turned around, and we're flying over the Everglades. And in the story, I talk about how I'm flying over the Everglades, and all I could think about was that pizza shop I worked in growing up. And, you know, that I was headed back to the pizza shop because they're going to rip us out of the airplane by our wings. And it was really cool. So we landed, and we went up, and I just, you know, I said, look, I'm going to stand beside you, you know. I mean, that's it. We really messed this one up. Because, see, the moral of the story is you have to have clear lines for what everybody's responsibility is. Well, the fly into, when Air Force One is something, they put out something called a TFR, and that's a temporary flight restriction. And we assume that we missed the TFR because nobody really knew who was doing the co-pilot's duties, and those would have been the co-pilot's duties. And I was the co-pilot. But since he was trying to divvy the duties up, you know, and trying to show me respect, because we were both aircraft commanders, and he was trying to help out with it. So we walk up, and we walk into the operation center, and we're just waiting for the whole command to be standing there and just, I mean, like, you know, D-Day. Well, I do the little, you know, the finger scanner thing, and I open up the vault door, and as I'm walking in, it's like operations is normal. So big angry, and he's a big guy, right? He grabs me, I mean, I'm 200 pounds. He grabs me. He's like 6'4". I mean, he's a big guy. He grabs me and yanks me backwards, and he looks at me, and he goes, "You take this to your grave." And I was like, "All right." He goes, "I'm going down to talk to the crew. You turn in the secret." And so I go in there. Well, it turns out I don't have to take it to the grave, because we were in there, and one of the instructors, neither of us were instructors at the time. One of the instructors was talking and said, "Hey, Air Force One is in Naples. They forgot to post the FTC notam. I mean, the chances of that happening are like never." So it's a really cool story. And I mean, you know, learning from it, and he actually lives down here. He's still a good friend of mine. And but you know, the life lessons that we learn, and taking them out and sharing them. You know, Tom, you mentioned that I'm a motivational speaker, and that's how this all kind of got started. Like, why I even wrote the book. And I was going around the schools, and I was speaking, and I was speaking on Never Give Up, because, like you said, you know, I went through this plane crash, and I'd gone through so much adversity in my life. And I mean, when I say adversity, I mean adversity, because you can imagine going through that and everything that comes with it. So, excuse me, I was going around the schools, and I was speaking, and one school in particular really touched me. I got to the school, and it was considered to be more of an inner city school, and I was told that, you know, that they really wouldn't listen to me. And I didn't take that to heart. I didn't think anything of it. I went in there, and I gave it 110%, and that's probably the biggest thing I took away from my near-death experience, is you need to give everything you do in life, you have to give it 110%. And if you don't mind, I would like to read one of the poems. In between each chapter, these kids wrote me poems, and they listened up well, and they really engaged me. Can I read one of the poems that one of the students wrote
me? I'm going to let Bobby react to that story about Air Force One. Do you got any comments on that, Bobby?
No, I'm really just enjoying listening to him describe that. I mean, that's so awesome.
Yeah, it really is, and I really enjoyed that part of the book. And there's many other stories in there, just as edge of your seat, if you will, exciting. So go ahead, Dave, my friend, go ahead and read the poems.
I will, Tom. And then the other thing is, you know, it's not like a normal book. I mean, anything Dave Moore does seems like it's never just the norm, because it is just a conglomerate of stories, and it's not only flying stories. There's stories from Seer School in there. You know, it just kind of gives a whole. It's a very well-rounded book, and I think it's just it's a good book, and I kept it short as my mentor wanted me to write it longer, because I have 100 more stories I could put in here. But I kept it short because there's a lot of people that are not avid readers, of course not your listeners, because this is the Writer Lounge, but a lot of, like, young managers or people that are in positions of management or as part of a team, as I talk about leading from the rear, that would be able to read this book, which is only 126 pages, as opposed to, per se, Bill Clinton's book, which is 400 pages. But anyways... This is what one of the students wrote and sent to me. "A kid once young and lazy is now a man with skills like crazy. Disciplined and fit for anything, strong and ready, exploring everything. Saving souls, flying high, even a writer, much to my surprise. Up, high up, way in the sky, one day I might see Captain David Moore, one pretty cool guy." So
no.
That girl, yeah, I mean, they wrote so many poems in there, and, you know, when I wrote my first book, I said, you know, if I make a difference in one person's life, this was all worth it. And so that's probably my pride in enjoying the book, or the kids that I touched. And, you know, we have a responsibility as a society for leadership. And right now, you know, I mean, I'm not getting into politics because I stay far away from it. But, you know, our government doesn't seem to be able to agree on anything. We can't pass a budget. It seems like you turn the the TV on, and it's, you know, it's the, you know, they're talking about we the Democrats or we the Republicans, and we kind of lose, like, we the people, which really set out to be.
Yes.
And the reason I'm so, you know what I mean, the reason I'm so passionate about leadership is it's like we've almost taken teams to fight against each other, and then there's infighting inside those teams where it's like, you know, we need to get back to, we need a really strong leader who can just bring us together as a country. And, you know, it starts at the lowest level. It starts at, you know, the businesses out there. You know, this is America competing against the rest of the world. This is us, you know, and it's not just a book for America, but, you know, we need to take some pride, and we need to go out there, and we need to, you know, we need to lead, and we need to lead with some integrity. And what you asked me before, you know, do you stand up to a boss that doesn't want you to do things that's not in your moral life? Absolutely. I do anyways, and I don't want to live any other way because, if you're asking me to do something that's not moral and ethical, then I'm not sure, you know, like, I'm in the wrong company. I need to go find a better fit for me, and shame on you for leading your company and asking us to do a moral and unethical thing. And
yep.
If you're not listening to your people, you know, who can you listen to better than the people that are right on the front line? You know,
exactly.
In theory, you know, there's a lot of theory out there, but I've worked in a steel mill when I was in college. I was working my way through college, and you know, it's like the guys who were working on the shop floor had these incredible ideas that would save money, would save time, it would save material product, but it was like nobody wanted to listen to it in management. Management and the union were constantly, you know, they were fighting each other instead of working together. And what my book is about, you know, about being a leader no matter what your position is in the company. And really, you know, when you join a company or, you know, you become part of that team and you need to engulf yourself and give that 110%. So that's
where
I'm trying to go with the leadership and team building.
Yeah, but Dave, in regards to that leadership that you just touched on, it is all about being a leader. But what is the one quality do you think that a leader cannot go without? What is the one, that one shining example of what embodies a leader that they could be a leader without?
You know, because the fact is, you know, you look at Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban is going to be a leader in one way because Mark Cuban physically, you know, he's 6'3". He's a big guy. He's boisterous. I've seen great leaders who are smaller women, you know, 100 pounds soaking wet, and they're great leaders. You know, everybody has to find their own leadership style, and that's going to be like Big Angry. It was his mere presence, and that played into his leadership style. But the one thing that all of us as leaders, the most important thing is empathy because none of us are perfect, but, you know, and you have to look at this person and say, you know, you just talked about, you know, I know, Tom, you know, since the last time I've been on the show, we built a friendship, and, you know, we all go through times in our life where we're on the top, we're in the middle, we're on the bottom, but as a leader, you know, I want people that are going to join my team. And I want them to join for the 20 to 30 years. I want to get those guys that are going to come in and say, hey, I want to be on Dave's team because, you know what, Dave, he cares about my family. He cares about how I'm doing. He cares about, you know, he does care about the end result because at the end of the day, you know, we have to make money. We have to, you know, we have to do business to stay in business. But, you know, if you come to me and say, look, I can make your life. I give an example about when I was the supply officer. And one of my workers, they came to me, and he was one of my top performers, you know, a shop floor guy, and as when you're in the military, they give you these things that are called collateral duties. Oftentimes, these collateral duties become your main job, and flying becomes your side job. Well, I really just wanted to be a pilot because I wanted to be out there. You know, the reason I joined was to be out in the action, to be in the, you know, be involved. So I'm running this shop. It's, you know, I have almost 30 employees. I have a $9 million budget. And one of my employees comes up to me, and, you know, he had a special needs daughter. And his daughter, I don't remember all the details, but if he could come a half hour later to work and leave a half hour later, it would greatly improve his life. Well, I was like, okay, no-brainer. You know, you show up 30 minutes later, you want to stay 30 minutes, no-brainer. I took it to my supervisor just because I knew I needed to, And but I just figured that nobody would really care. It was almost like I just kind of brought it up on the side note. And my supervisor gave me this speech, and he said to me, he said, Dave, he said, the Coast Guard is a business, just like Walmart. Do you think Walmart cares if their employees have a reason? And I was like, I was taken back. And at the end of the speech, he looked at me and he said, so go do the right thing. So I did. I went and did the right thing. I let the guy come in 30 minutes late and leave 30 minutes later. But, you know, to me, how could you be so cold and so insensitive and so stuck because our hours are from 7 to 3:30 that we're not going to be flexible to that, but somebody else's needs, it's almost ridiculous in my mind.
And you got to be flexible in any position that you're in. You've got to allow the people below you to flex a little bit. Bobby, do you have any comments on what Dave is saying?
No, absolutely. You know, I when I was in the military, I was in the Marines, and I went through my share of leaders who had that attitude, and you know how this is, Dave. It's my way or the highway, and you do everything the way I say it. But I had this one lieutenant who had been enlisted, but then became an officer. Got his degree, became an officer, and I saw a significant difference between the leadership qualities of our early leaders and then this leader. And he did a lot of what you say, and it's really a stuff that's coming from the heart. It comes from a place of understanding and using common sense rather than the ego. And I think that's really an important point to bring out. It's common sense that brings us to the idea that working in your business and in your life this way is the way that will be more effective to everyone involved, everyone around you. So, yeah, I love what you're saying. I'm just listening.
Yes.
Enjoying it.
No, and you get it. And that's called a Mustang when they go enlisted to an officer. But it's the absolute truth because, you know, my supply shop ended up being the supply shop used as the model for the rest of the supply shops, not because I knew more about supply and accounting because I didn't know anything about it. I knew how to lead the people that did know about it. And let me tell you, those guys worked their butts. And when I say guys, I mean guys and girls. They worked their butts off for me because they knew at the end of the day that I had their back. And when somebody has your back and you know that they'll do whatever they can to help you, you know, who wants to be in a one-sided relationship when it's all about me? It's all about what you can do for me. If I extend that hand and give back to you, now it's like, wow, you know, he's really looking out for me. So let's take care of, you know, Dave, Mr. Moore, whatever. And you're so true. And I do believe. And you really just explained what I'm trying to do with my whole book. See what you just said about, and it's not the officer's fault or the managers who go and are high achievers all their lives, and they never work in the steel mill. They never work in the pizza shop. They never have those experiences. And unless you have those experiences, it's hard to be empathetic or understand from the other point of view unless you've been the one that's been in that position. And that's where I think the breakdown is. So my book is, I kind of try to show everybody's point of view and make, you know, so it's when I said empathy, it's like understanding people, understanding the situation, understanding their needs, their wants, their desires, and then, you know, making, I always say, it's a good deal when it's good for Dave. It's a great deal when it's good for everyone. And I like to make great deals. You know, I like to go out there and make things so it's just good for everyone. And thank you for your service, by the way. I have a great Marine story.
Thank you.
Yeah, Dave, we don't know if we're going to get to that story since we've only got like 5 minutes left here to do the whole show, but I would like to once again thank you for being on the Writer's Lounge. I do consider you a good friend. You did help me out in a situation that I had last year, and you called me up and we talked, and you were very helpful, and There's something about you that has people turning toward you and listening. You are a good leader, in my opinion, and I wish you much success in all of your endeavors. But before you go, two things. I would like to know, what is it about flying an airplane that appeals to you most, and where can we find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on the internet at More Motivated, M-O-O-R-E, motivated.com. And what appeals to me most about flying an airplane? It's a lot of fun. I mean, it's just it's something when it gets in your blood, it's something. I guess it was my drug growing up. It was what excited me. It made me happy. It gave me a goal. It gave me a purpose, and it gave me something that I could focus on. And it's just really cool. I mean, doing loops and rolls and doing it in the military. I mean, really, anybody that's out there, you know, young guys, men and women, why wouldn't you go to the military and go ahead and go have fun with them? I mean, they'll let you do things that you never get to do, you know, otherwise in your life. I think it's a great experience for a lot. You know, some people stay in forever. Some people get, you know, they do it 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Flying in the military, I mean, the Coast Guard, I got to fly through 3 hurricanes low level with them. You know, I've gotten to see so much. It's been unbelievable. It's been an unbelievable journey.
Yeah, and Dave, whether you're flying a plane or making a pizza, there's something about you that's fun, and I think that's a big part of it, too. And I appreciate it, my friend, and thank you so much for being on Writer's Lounge, and we'll be looking for you again here in the near future, okay?
All right, guys. Hey, have a great one, and thanks for having me on.
Okay.
Bye,
Take
Dave.
Take care, Dave. Yep.
We'll
bye-bye.
See you. Bye-bye.
Okay, Bobby, it ends. I want to make sure I don't click you off this time, because last time I hung up on you, and I didn't want to do that again. But we will be back in 2 weeks with Christy Tajordan. Uncharted
okay.
Secrets is her book. And any quick passing thoughts on your end, Bobby?
Well, you know, I really enjoyed listening and talking to Dave. This was a really great interview. I want to give a shout out to Andy Lyons, who's out there listening to us tonight. Sure wish we could have had some time to take some phone calls for Dave. I'm not sure that she called in, but I know she's out there listening. She's typing on Facebook about the show, so it's good to have you out there.
Great.
And,
great.
So, yes, and anyone else who is listening to the show, if you want to contact either of us via Twitter or Facebook, please feel free to do that. We'd be really glad to hear from you and be glad to give you a shout-out, too.
Thank you, Bobby, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. And everybody, let the story begin. Get writing. See you later.
Bye-bye.
In the middle of the day, your faith and your fences have been blown away. You're down in the cellar and you've locked yourself in. Ah, but it looks like it's rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out. And it looks like it's rainbow weather again. God spoke to Noah one beautiful morn. He said, Noah, get ready, for the sky will be torn. Build as I tell you, save what you can. Then wait while the rainbow weather begins. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out on a westerly wind. And it looks like it's rainbow weather again. Trouble will come, but trouble will go. You're living in fear, but what do you know? You know that the sun's always coming then. You know there'll be rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds will part and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out. Like it's rainbow weather. Yeah, it looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds apart.